This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today on the broadcast, the changing face of foreclosure. Also, what it's like when a campaign really wants your vote. And our series Economy 4.0, the electronically unbanked. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information available at newsstands every Saturday. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today. This one is the 28th of October. Glad to have you with us. There is a certain intellectual inconsistency to the American real estate market as we make our way through the last quarter of 2010. It may strangely be the best of times and the worst of times all rolled into one. We learned this morning that it's possible to borrow hundreds of thousands of dollars for 30 years and pay just 4.25% interest on it. 4.23% for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, to be exact. That is up just a hair from last week, but still close to the lowest rate in decades. And yet, distress among homeowners who are in trouble continues, and almost everything the government has tried has come up short. Our Washington Bureau Chief Don Dimsdale explains why.
When the Making Home Affordable Program, or HAMP, started back in early 2009, President Obama set a goal of reducing payments on over 3 million mortgages. So far, less than 500,000 have been modified, and at a congressional oversight panel hearing yesterday, member Richard Nieman said HAMP's future looks no brighter.
The number of new homeowners entering the program each month is now near its lowest point.
And many homeowners who got their loans adjusted still can't meet the monthly payments. Those adjustments include spreading mortgages out over more years, reducing interest rates, and in some cases, lowering the principal. But making them has run into a lot of snags. NYU housing professor Lawrence White says lenders worry.
Well, if I do a special break for this guy, are all my other borrowers going to start coming in and say, oh, I can't repay, do a special deal for me?
Plus, White says most mortgages have been sold to investors who expect a return, and some are willing to sue the lender to collect. And now shoddy paperwork makes it difficult to find the legitimate title holder. Finally, Julia Gordon at the Center for Responsible Lending says the second part of the government's loan modification program was never approved.
Originally, the administration's foreclosure prevention plan included a change to the bankruptcy code that would have allowed bankruptcy judges to modify mortgages.
If Congress were to approve the threat of modifications in bankruptcy court, Gordon says lenders would feel more pressure to seriously consider easier terms on mortgages that are otherwise headed for foreclosure. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So we've been talking about foreclosures now for what, years, since the housing market peaked in 2005, 2006 at least. And while the basic details of the transactions themselves haven't really changed, buyers unable to make their payments, who's getting foreclosed on has changed. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports that in some cases, it's no longer the usual suspects.
Foreclosures have come in waves. The first,
an exotic toxic mortgage crisis.
That's Susan Wachter from the Wharton School of Business. The initial foreclosure wave was the subprime crash. The second, says Wachter, a wave with long-lasting ripples.
A job loss phase.
And third, another wave that continues swamping the housing market.
It is primarily a phase of homeowners who are underwater.
A quarter of U.S. homes are worth less than their mortgages, Wachter says. It's a cycle that's hard to break out of. Foreclosures push down home prices, push homeowners further underwater, push up foreclosures. Jacob Brown from St. Paul, Minnesota, was one of those submerged homeowners. Brown left one job and took another that paid less, so he tried to sell his house.
Stayed on the market for almost a year before I finally just gave up.
He got behind in mortgage payments.
You know, I'd kind of reached a point of, do I pay the mortgage on this place that I'm not going to be able to save, or do I, and not pay any of my other bills, or do I pay my other bills?
Brown paid his other bills. The homeowner with work and a 30-year fixed-rate loan isn't the only new face of the foreclosure crisis. RealtyTrack's list of cities with the highest year-over-year increase in foreclosure activity includes metro areas you don't associate with the housing bubble: Seattle, Chicago, Houston. Ted Gehr is with the Brookings Institution. He says now we're seeing the causes of foreclosure, the waves of unemployment and negative equity, all jumbled up.
In some sense, it's one big wave that is still going.
And he's not optimistic it'll clear anytime soon. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Away from housing, it was kind of an day in the American economy. Corporate profits disappointed, but new weekly numbers from the labor market were a tad better than expected. And so on Wall Street today, mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Most of the campaign finance stories this election cycle have been asking different versions of the same question. Where is the money coming from? We humbly submit there is another question worth asking as well. Where's it all going? There are, of course, staff salaries to pay and transportation expenses and the zillion other things that grease the gears of politics. But a big chunk of the money goes to ads, and a part of that chunk is increasingly being used to target a very specific slice of the voting population. So today we wrap up our series on the behind-the-scenes work of an election with a somewhat different spin. Commentator Gustavo Arellano and what it's like to be in the campaign crosshairs.
American politicians want me. I'm a Hispanic voter. Actually, call me Latino. Actually, just call me a voter, won't you? Every 2 years, candidates and propositions, Democrats and Republicans bombard me with pleas to vote their way because they, and only they, best understand my community. They understand how to make me economically secure. My family and I have made quite a pretty peso recycling all the bilingual flyers sent our way over the years. We've hung up way too many times to count on robocalls that court us in English and Español. And we always laugh when some Paul tries to get down with la raza by slugging back a shot of tequila or eating at a taqueria. What do Latino voters want? As one of them, and as one who knows hundreds, it's surprisingly simple. Immigration is a huge issue, of course, but we need jobs. The unemployment rate for Latinos is around 12%, which is much higher than the national unemployment rate. Of course, we want better schools and less taxes. Also, the American Southwest returned to Mexico. And before you write a comment on the Marketplace website, I'm kidding. But seriously, the typical Latino voter is more classically conservative than the media hype suggests, and various studies have shown this over the years. We are not glued to any particular political persuasion. The most important issue for us, though, is respect. The minute some politician rails about Latinos not learning English or an illegal immigrant invasion, we vote the other side. Lose the hate speech. If we can cast a ballot, that means we're legally American. And woe to the party that crosses us once too often. We'll stop being a sleeping giant, flex our political muscle, and make you sigh, ay caramba, come election day.
Gustavo Arellano writes the Ask a Mexican column for the Orange County Weekly. You can write to us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There's no shortage of ideas about what to do to fix the economy. You plow more money in, you cut taxes, you help small businesses, you create jobs, you fix the budget deficit. I could go on. You get the point. Glenn Hubbard has more experience than most in coming up with those kinds of ideas. He ran the Council of Economic Advisors for President George W. Bush. He's the dean of the Columbia Business School right now. He's also a frequent commentator on this program. And he has written a new book about our economic distress. It's called Seeds of Destruction. Glenn, it's good to have you with us.
Pleasure.
This is a policy paper as much as it is an actual book, and you've got recommendations for everything from trade policy to energy policy to interest rates to entitlements. But if you try to fix everything, you wind up fixing nothing, right? So pick one. Is there a key that is going to get this economy going?
Yes. I mean, the first thing to do is to realize what the actual problem is. We're facing long-term structural problems. And so the goal is to get the U.S. to pivot much more toward a saving and investment society.
Pivot implies moving with speed, though, and alacrity, not something the American government or the American people do.
No, I think it's just the opposite. What I argue in the book is if we make a gradual shift toward greater public and private saving, toward more investment for our future, we can pull this off.
So what's the first step then, Glenn?
Well, I think the first step as a matter of the budget is to say, let's look at our long-term budget problems and get something going right. What I think is important for the budget is to focus government where government is needed. Frankly, I think we need a stronger social safety net. What we can't afford as a society is a large, open-ended entitlement program like we have with Social Security and Medicare. But the guts of these programs for people who need them are essential.
All right, so I'm going to bait you a little bit on this one. What about raising taxes?
Well, you know, frankly, that's something we're going to have to consider. If the American people actually want a government as big as the one we now have, we would have to raise every tax by a very large amount.
Okay, but wait a minute. I mean, you are the guy who helped write the Bush-era tax cuts that Congress is going to be taking up when it gets back, whether to extend them or not. The Congressional Budget Office came out the other day and said, you know what, if we do extend these tax cuts, it will hurt the economy. It will add to the debt and do bad things. So make the case for me then that cutting taxes is okay.
Well, I don't think that's what the CBO says. You look at one side of it, which is the debt. There's no doubt about it. And simulations from almost all economic forecasters would have positive benefits of the tax cuts. But it's not the right question. The real discussion is not whether to extend the tax cuts, but what's the size of government? If we really want the government that's in President Obama's budget, we need to repeal all of the 2001-2003 tax cuts and then some. We probably need a new tax system.
Say that again. Repeal those tax cuts? Did you really just say that?
If you want a government that big, I don't. But if the American people say we would like a government that's running 5 and the out years up to 10 percentage points of GDP more than we're raising in revenue, yes, we have to raise taxes. The difference I would have from the administration is you can't kid yourself into thinking you only have to raise high-income people's taxes. We'd have to raise all taxes, everybody, to close the gap.
So if smaller government then means doing something about Social Security and doing something about Medicare, get specific for me. What do we do? Do we cut people's entitlements?
Well, you know, a simple place to start would be to say, well, what are your principles? And that if we're going to have to make adjustments, the adjustments ought to be borne by the most well-off among us, not by the least well-off. So tangibly, what that would mean for Social Security is strong minimum benefits for Americans, but very slow growth in benefits over time for upper-income households. There are many ways to do that, but most of those ways would have actuarial balance in Social Security that is not the big unfunded deficits and liabilities that we have now.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the business school at Columbia University. He's also an occasional commentator for this program. His new book is called Seeds of Destruction. Glenn, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, the real costs of electronic banking.
$9 or $10 a month, that's a lot of money to someone that makes $10 an hour and can't even afford computer access.
Our series, Economy 4.0, coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street played the waiting game today. The Dow Industrials backed up 12 points, about a 10%, closed at 11,113. The NASDAQ put on 4 points, also a 10%, 2507 at the bell. The S&P 500 ticked up a single point, 0.1%. Again, ended things at 11.83. It's all about the Fed, by the way, next week's midterm elections, of course. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley both climbed nearly 2% today. Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase each lost less than 1%. Citigroup pretty much stood still. Halliburton shares, they hit the floor after a presidential commission said the cement used to seal the BP well down in the Gulf this past spring was unstable and that Halliburton's product may have contributed to the worst oil spill in U.S. history. The stock slid nearly 8% on this Thursday. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.66%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its advance estimate third quarter gross domestic product report. Just in time for Halloween, Saw 3D opens in theaters. Scary. Tomorrow is also the anniversary of Black Tuesday. On October 29, 1929, Wall Street crashed, ushering in the Depression. Very scary. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and we are going to pause for a moment now to talk about corporate giving and perhaps corporate getting. Nordstrom, the big retailer out of Seattle, says it's going to open a store in New York, all the profits from which will go to charity. All profits. Sounds on the face of it like a pretty good corporate deed, but cynics among us might well wonder, with the economy making retail triple markdowns a fact of life, who do you suppose is getting more out of this arrangement, the charity or the company? Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Nordstrom will open its philanthropic concept store in Soho, a hip, high-traffic neighborhood. Rents there are pricey. They average about $200 a square foot. So why would Nordstrom donate the profits from this new store to charity? Retail analyst Patricia Edwards at Tritina Financial has one answer.
I think this is a fantastically crazy idea because it not only benefits the charities, but it also improves the Nordstrom brand in Manhattan, where they want to be able to bring a full-line store.
Nordstrom has wanted to open a flagship store in New York for years. Its new store will be just a few corners away from New York icon Bloomingdale's, with the added benefit that you don't have to feel guilty about buying that Marc Jacobs bag when you know the proceeds will go to charity. Social entrepreneurs and philanthropy experts applaud Nordstrom's plans, with some reservations.
You want to be careful that it's not seen as being exploitive.
That's Christopher Gergen with the Heart Leadership Program at Duke University.
Consumers are getting more and more sophisticated. And if they feel like they're getting taken for a ride, they're basically just providing a lot of marketing bump for Nordstrom, that's going to create a level of cynicism that's going to be hard to recover from.
Many of the details about the new store remain sketchy. There's no name for it yet, but it won't be called Nordstrom, and it won't be a mini version of the department store. A spokeswoman says Nordstrom hasn't decided which charities will benefit from the store's profits, and those profits could be pretty slim by the time it opens next fall. Profits at nearly all retail stores have been hammered since the recession. Nordstrom's fell from about 8% a few years ago to 5.8% last quarter. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
All across America tonight, millions of people at almost the same time and with almost the same set of emotions are going to do something that's really bad for the planet. We're going to pick up the clicker, we're going to plop down on the living room couch, and we are going to turn on our big screen TVs to watch the World Series. Those things draw power just as bad, and the big ones may be worse than refrigerators and washing machines, appliances that are required to have stickers on them telling you exactly how much energy they use. So now the Federal Trade Commission says maybe it's time for TVs, the big ones, to have energy labels too. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troe reports.
The average 34-inch TVs of a few years ago are like chihuahuas compared to today's 60-inch Great Danes. And like a Great Dane, those big TVs eat more. They gobble electricity.
From 10 to 25% of a household's energy use is dependent on the television and the surrounding peripherals like the cable box and game consoles and stuff like that.
David Katzmeyer reviews TVs for CNET. He says most consumers buy a TV for the picture quality. Energy is not even a factor. A quick survey on the streets of New York shows he's right.
Energy? No.
No, zero. Zero energy usage.
No, I never really thought too much about the energy. I kind of assume that everything's energy efficient, but I don't really look, I guess.
Starting in May, it'll be hard to switch off information about how much energy your TV uses. Every new set will sport a big yellow tag with the cost to power it for a year. Websites that sell TVs will also have to provide that information. David Katzmeyer at CNET says that probably won't stop anyone bent on buying a gargantuan plasma screen, the biggest energy suckers. But annual energy cost could influence people choosing between TVs that are about the same size and quality.
Even if it is only a difference of, say, $20, $30 a year, that might actually be enough to make you, decide to get the more efficient one.
When you consider that Americans now have an average of three TVs per household and that they're on about 8 hours a day, the new FTC tags do have potential to change the picture. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Technology can fix a lot of things. Not everything, of course, but if you can bring the conveniences of modern electronic life to bear on a problem, often you have a better chance at making things right. That's part of how we might make the global economy work better for more people. Technology and finance are natural partners. Banks are almost universally online. It's a trend so ingrained that some are now charging fees for paper copies of monthly banking statements. And how fast we get shoved toward higher tech banking could well be an early test of new consumer protections for people who have internet connections. Our special correspondent, David Brancaccio, takes our series on globalization, Economy 4.0, to the land the internet forgot up in northern New Hampshire.
So what would you say is the best thing about living in this part of the wilderness?
The people, the sense of community. It's just wonderful.
And what's the worst?
The internet.
The internet? I had a feeling you were going to say that. That's why I'm here.
We're talking in the kitchen of Kathy Johnson's farmhouse outside Colebrook, New Hampshire.
All right, so quick, let's get back to that browser.
Okay, I want to get into this fast before we lose it.
And it's creepy.
It's chugging along.
I don't know if we can call that chugging, Kathy. It's kind of creeping.
Cable and DSL don't make it to the house. Kathy felt internet via satellite was too intermittent, so now it's internet through the mobile phone system.
This may take a while.
Today's digital performance of Waiting for Godot is so Kathy can get a look at her bank statement online. The bank with her personal account still sends monthly statements printed on paper through the mail for free, old school. But this year, one of her business accounts started charging money for paper statements.
That's right.
How much?
$9.99 a month.
Really?
Yes.
When did you actually notice?
My paper bank statement is how I found it.
It's a growing trend in banking. For instance, Bank of America has something called the e-banking account, where paper statements and routine visits to a human teller cost money. It's now in more than three dozen states. B of A says techno-savvy customers seem fine with online only in exchange for no minimum cash balances in the account. Bank analysts say it's an experiment being watched with interest throughout the industry. But with the latest FCC figures showing as many as 24 million people, that's 1 in 12, living in dead zones devoid of fast internet, some consumer advocates are skeptical. I talked to Lauren Bown, a staff attorney at Consumers Union in San Francisco.
The first thing that comes to mind is people without internet access at all, but also very low-income people, the elderly, and generally just people who have spent a lifetime managing their finances on paper. They're used to doing it one way, and it will disproportionately affect them if they have this choice taken away from them.
Kathy Johnson saw that play out in her own kitchen.
In fact, this morning, there's a lady that comes and cleans my house. I told her a little bit about this new paper statement fee, and she was horrified. You know, $9 or $10 a month or whatever it is, that's a lot of money to someone that makes $10 an hour and doesn't have can't even afford computer access or doesn't know how to use a computer.
At least one U.S. senator has called for the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to crack down on charges for paper statements. The Bureau, now being set up in Washington, is the brainchild of Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren. She told me her team could try what's called crowdsourcing, in which consumers, via computer, become the eyes and ears of this new financial cop on the beat.
Look, technology is going to be terrific. It's going to change cost structures. It's going to give us new opportunities to analyze and understand problems. But it's important for this agency not to forget that not everyone has been swept up into the new technological age. There are many people who, for different reasons, different circumstances, are still dealing in a paper and phone call world, and this agency belongs to them as well.
Emerging new technology could make it easier for consumers to shop around if they don't like the terms of their bank account. Still, modern accounts with direct deposit and online payments can be complicated to switch. Then there's Kathy Johnson's challenge.
Take it back to being in the rural area. You don't have a lot of options for other banks. We have two banks in town.
You just go online. There must be tons of competition. Oh, wait a minute. Your internet doesn't work all that well.
That's right.
In Colebrook, New Hampshire, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
David and Economy 4.0 are online for us as well. He's blogging and sharing stories from the road at our homepage at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, picking up on my earlier observation about watching the World Series. Am I the only guy who's been wondering what's with those enormous necklaces that some of those players are wearing? I mean, those things are so big, some of them are practically horse collars. Turns out, should you be so inclined, you can buy one yourself online. Just do a search on titanium necklace by a company called Phiten, I think it's pronounced, P-H-I-T-E-N. They are made, or so it says, of aqua titanium, whatever that is. Apparently it helps regulate the body's natural electric currents through cell ionization, or something, whatever. In any case, Giants in six, you heard it here first. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow backed up 12 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ put on 4 points, also a tenth percent. The S&P 500 ticked up 1 point, also a tenth of 1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, why one of the guys behind Lost is so happy not to be part of November Sweeps.
We'd be blue skying the story for one, writing the script of another, rewriting the script that we'd rushed through previously, shooting the one we'd just rewritten, and editing the one we just shot.
Who knew television was so hard? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.